VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo. An interesting saying that kind of sets the theme for today's program is, "He who controls information controls the world." Within the last 20 to 30 years, Silicon Valley tech companies such as Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, and Alphabet, the parent company of Google, have revolutionized the transmission and reception of information and knowledge, deeply impacting the lives of millions of people from around the world. While most of us have greatly benefited from the efforts provided by these tech companies, there are those, including today's guest, who contend that relying on companies that provide this technology could also cost us our privacy and even our own individuality. My guest for today's program is Franklin Foer. Mr. Foer is a reporter for the magazine The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation, which is a nonpartisan think tank based here in Washington, D.C. He was formerly the editor of the liberal-leaning magazine The New Republic. Franklin Foer has also authored a new book called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, and he joins us by telephone today. Franklin, regarding that saying, he who controls information controls the world, do you agree with it? And how could this provide some context concerning the impact modern information technology has on today's world?
Well, clearly that's a time-honored principle. Dictators have known that going back all the way to ancient times. And in our current world, we have this new constellation of gatekeepers. One of the facts of living in a democracy is that citizens need to have information, and citizens can't be expected to know everything about everything. And so opinion, information, argument gets sorted for them. We have to rely on other people to some extent to tell us what's important and what to think. But we've got these new systems for providing information. Namely, I'm thinking about Google and Facebook. And Facebook has become a primary source of information for a huge number of people around the world. And Facebook creates this illusion that nobody's in control of the system except for you and your friends, that you're getting this curated batch of news and information and entertainment. And of course, that's not entirely the case, because if you were just to rely on the information that came from your friends, it would be just this unusable mass. And so Facebook has algorithms, which are these invisible processes for making some things rise to the top of your news feed and other things drop. And so Facebook is able to exert an enormous amount of influence over what you're reading and what you're seeing. And that power gives them the power to essentially control your information diet. In a democracy, that's a pretty core source of power.
You bring up an excellent point, and it's the fact that even though the technology has given us more information or more access to information than ever before, it's definitely different from the old days of when you had like three major network newscasts and a couple of newspapers in a particular market where you didn't have as much to grab from. Now, it seems like there's way too much to grab from as far as getting information, and as a result, you wind up being susceptible to what they're calling fake news.
Right. Well, it's this incredible paradox, right? That we've never been so awash in information and so many sources of news, yet it's all flowing through one or two big pipes. Mm-hmm. And that means that the people who control the pipes have the power. It's a bit of a paradox.
My concern is the effect this kind of technology and the way it's being distributed is having on democracy itself.
Right. Well, so you just previously asked about fake news. And the problem is that Facebook is just a stew of information. And in order to succeed in Facebook as a media organization, you need to provide the headline that makes people click. And unfortunately, in Facebook's informational ecosystem, the authority of the purveyor of information is diminished. Everything becomes about the headline. Nothing becomes about the authority of the people who are providing it. And so in that sort of stew, it's easily exploited by bad actors. Part of Facebook is this feedback loop. Facebook gives you what you want. Facebook has this enormous trove of data, which is this intimate portrait of your habits and what it knows about you. And it exploits that data to try to give you what you want. And so if you're liberal, if you're conservative, you live in what's been called a filter bubble, where you're constantly getting information that confirms your point of view and very little that attempts to dissuade you from your point of view. And so when somebody drops a conspiracy theory into your Facebook feed, whether it's the Russians or some wackadoodle news site, you're apt to believe it because that's just the way in which you've been preconditioned. Your ability to distinguish between the fake and the real has been diminished. And the ability of authoritative sources to swat away the fake has also been diminished.
So in other words, you're saying that algorithms such as what Facebook uses basically tells us what we want to hear.
Yeah, it does. It's this cycle that they've set up because Facebook's goal isn't to have you walk away being an educated citizen. It's to have you spend as much time as possible on the website. They want to keep you clicking. And the best way to keep you clicking is to make you feel good, to make you feel like your belief system is constantly being affirmed.
And plus clicks equal dollars, too.
Yeah, that's at the core of the whole system, is that the longer you spend on the site, the more advertising you're watching, which is more revenue for Facebook.
The other aspect of digital news compared to traditional standard newspapers, television, etc., is the interactivity part of it. And that, I think, is somehow getting in between what we should be getting as far as information, the straight information, because you're getting it sort of massaged by people making comments on a story.
Right. I mean, there is that. I mean, I think that what the interactivity has contributed to is also to this diminishment of authority. So on Facebook, the idea is that your uncle's opinion is of equal value to the opinion of, say, the New York Times. And they're all treated in the same sort of fashion and with the same equal standing. And so in this environment, there is this relativism that seeps in, and it's this diminishment of our ability to navigate the sourcing of our information. And that interactivity that you just described is actually, in the end, somewhat debilitating to us as consumers of news and information.
It seems as though we need some help in deciding what we need, what we really need to see and what we really need to read. And what winds up when you're having, again, multiple sources of information, and if you wind up with a system that's almost like the old telephone game.
Yeah, right.
Someone says something at first and it sort of, the story sort of changes a few stories down.
You know, the question is then how do we diminish this? And there are two principles that come to mind. One is that we actually need gatekeepers, and that gatekeepers always exist. There's in the Facebook system, there is a gatekeeper, and it's called the algorithm. In newspapers, gatekeepers exist. It's the editor, it's the publisher, and essentially, we need people to help us sort information. And we can pretend like we hate these people, and therefore, we get a system like Facebook, which just is responsive to the market and it's just giving people what they want. Or we do it in a much more deliberate sort of way where we acknowledge the power of the gatekeepers and force the gatekeepers to have some sort of sense of obligation to the democracy and some sort of sense of constraints on their own power. And then the second is that if we have gatekeepers, and once we acknowledge the prevalence of gatekeepers, the other principle is that we don't want them to get too powerful because having one pipe through which information flows is really just unhealthy for democracy. Because even if the gatekeeper is acting in good faith, it's just too much responsibility to be pinned on one organization or individual.
Is there such a thing these days, in today's environment, as a really balanced source of news? I mean, I know here at VOA, we work our hardest to be totally balanced with what we present on the air and through the web and on television. But it seems as though people tend to gravitate toward media sources that sort of feed into their mindset.
Well, I still think that the big three American newspapers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, are fairly balanced. And I look at a lot of television news, and they still make an effort to be balanced. I think NPR makes an effort to be balanced. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying that they don't have certain skews, but they're adhering to an ideal of objectivity. And so, I mean, this is really actually, I think, pretty crucial to our system, which is that in the last 20, 30, 40 years, we've had the sense that objectivity is kind of a sham concept, mm-hmm. that nobody can really be objective because at the end of the day, we all have biases, right? Mm-hmm. And that's true. Like, there's no doubt about that. But there is still something about adhering to this ideal of producing objective facts and really trying to hold yourself to that standard and to have a set of rules that enforces that ideal of objectivity. I think that's hugely important for democracy, that we really need organizations that strive to provide a common basis for fact. Because if we don't have a common set of facts, it becomes very hard for us to have debates that are remotely productive.
In today's world, wouldn't that most of that responsibility lie on the actual media consumer?
I mean, unfortunately, that's a problem, is that if you are a reader, and even a relatively well-informed one, it's an incredibly complicated world. If you just look at the big public policy debates of our time, from healthcare to climate change, to financial regulation, to how we deal with the internet, they're all so complicated. I was an editor of a magazine. I published a ton of pieces about healthcare reform. Even having read all those pieces about healthcare reform, if you ask me to explain various basic parts of the healthcare system, I bet you would be able to flummox me, mm-hmm. because these issues are so complicated. And I think that there's a limit to what we can expect the average citizen to do, let alone a lot of the elites, to sort through these issues. And so we need to be able to defer to some sort of journalistic authority, some sort of expert opinion. And everything that's happened in our society is mitigated against that. And then you have Facebook and Google coming in, kind of delivering this knockout blow to the ideas of objectivity and authority.
Franklin, you recently wrote an essay that I happened to read in the Washington Post, and I understand it's based on your new book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. How is Silicon Valley doing this? How's it robbing us of our individuality?
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about the Silicon Valley corporations is that they're idealistic. And when we think about them, we think about Silicon Valley, we like to think that they're libertarian and that they're kind of anti-government, pro-individual. But really, I spent all this time trying to study the history of technology and studying the statements of the people who run these big tech companies. And what I concluded is that they were all about sticking people into one giant, massive group, and that their dream was to have everybody be part of almost a herd, of a collective. So they talk about the network and the social media and their goal and collaboration. And their goal is to have everybody stitched together into this one thing. And they're so desirous of rushing us into this one big thing that they just have very little sympathy for the individual and individuality. And I think that this helps explain why they've shredded our ideas about privacy. It's why they really want, they believe in systems. They want the systems and these algorithms to basically replace individual choices that we make as an individual as we go about our day. They dislike the idea of authorship, which is a pretty core concept of expressing individual. They aspire to be monopolies, and they celebrate monopolies as opposed to having a diverse competitive marketplace. And so you just need to kind of scan the entire horizon, and you see this really chilling view of the individual emerge.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/p. SBC USA. We would like to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA and would appreciate it if you would take our brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel VOA. Thank you for your help as we work to improve Press Conference USA for you. Today, we're examining the impact, both good and bad, of today's top Silicon Valley information technology companies on our daily lives. My guest today is Franklin Foer, author of a new book called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, which has been published by Penguin Press. Franklin, in a piece that appeared earlier this year in the New York Times, author journalist Farad Manju identified several companies he dubbed as tech's frightful five, which are Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, and Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. I've also seen them referred to, minus Microsoft, as GAFA, G-A-F-A. Your take on these companies and how they've impacted daily life?
Well, so these guys are at the core of my book, and especially the GAFA companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. And what's so striking about these companies is their ambition, that they want to be everything companies. Mm-hmm. So Amazon started off being a bookseller, and then it morphed into being the everything store, and it morphed into being a movie studio and to running the cloud, and now it owns Whole Foods. And there's kind of no limit to the boundaries of these companies. And then the other thing about these companies is that they kind of aspire to integrate themselves really deeply into our lives. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that they're in a race for right now is to become our personal assistants. And so there's Amazon Echo, and there's Google has a product in its home, and they want to have these, and Facebook talks about having a personal butler. And so they want to have these artificial intelligence machines basically in constant conversation with us over the course of the day. And so you ask yourself, well, that sounds pretty great. Why would we have any skepticism about those products? Well, there are two reasons. One is that these companies have amassed incredible troves of data about us. In some ways, they know us better than we know ourselves. And so they try to use that data in order to guide us. And in some ways, it's kind of benign and benevolent. So they try to understand our schedules, and they want to help us figure out how to get from point A to point B, or what tasks to do next. But in some ways, it's a little bit more commercial incentive, where they want to try to guide the ways in which we consume items, in which we consume media. And that's where we start to see that they're exerting tremendous amounts of power over markets and over information. And once you start to have that kind of power over markets and information, you've got a lot of power to impact democracy.
Many people were drawn to things like Google, for example, because of its features. It's visually attractive and entertaining, and it provides kind of an instant gratification to its users, being able to access any kind of information you want at a click of a mouse. And that used to take a lot of effort to obtain. So basically, what role do you think these big companies are playing? And it's not just the big companies. It's a lot of startups as well taking advantage of it. You have this thing called the Internet of Everything.
Yeah, the Internet of Things. So what you're capturing is exactly right, which is that there is this air of benevolence that the companies have that they pretend to be neutral in a lot of ways. So Google is just a search engine. And even the idea of a search engine implies that it's delivering you a scientific result, when in fact we know that that's not the case, that they're imposing hierarchy on information. There's no neutral way you can organize information. There's some values that are permitting you to say that this one thing is more important than another thing. And so that's kind of part of the trick. When you mentioned startups, I think one thing that's striking is that we just don't have as many startups as we used to. And you can see people writing about this among economists and in the business press. And there are a lot of theories about why we don't have as many startups as we used to. But one of the core theories that I think has a wide degree of acceptance is that when you have an economy that's so concentrated, when you have companies that are so powerful and are able to, these guys are able to buy up the best talent and pay them the best wages. And it's so hard to imagine dislodging Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, or Microsoft, and they're extending themselves into every single area. It has a almost demoralizing effect on entrepreneurship.
What you're bringing up and what you're mentioning sort of reminds me of the old robber barons from the late 1800s, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgan. Are we back to that? In your opinion?
Back to that and then some. I mean, I think it's useful to look at historic parallels and to see the ways in which the current patterns of behavior are replicating things that have gone before us. And I think that sometimes there's something comforting in looking at the past, where, you know, we had these big corporations and the problems ultimately were able to, in a way, resolve themselves. But we forget kind of how painful that process was, that it took a lot of people complaining. It took periods where people actually suffered under the thumbs of these companies. And it took many years to rally public opinion to culminate and political action getting taken.
But the one thing, in all honesty, Franklin, to be fair, is that the fundamental products of these big companies like Google, Facebook, et cetera, is that they do provide a relatively valuable service to the people who use their products. And, you know, they happen to go on to do other things after establishing themselves. Like you, as you mentioned, Google was founded primarily as a search engine, and it's still being used as a search engine. Apple is another one. Apple started up as a way from two guys working in a garage who wanted to put the computer in the hands of the everyday person. But they've grown from that. Isn't that expected to happen, to grow from an original idea that consumers consider valuable?
Totally. I mean, I think that their products are amazing. And the technologies that they've created are incredible feats of human ingenuity. And I use them all personally all the time. I'm talking to you on an iPhone. And I did research on my book using Google. And there were books that I bought on it via Amazon. And those are all incredible developments. You know, but the problem is we can really appreciate these companies and appreciate the good that they've done for humanity while simultaneously also worrying about their power and worrying about some of the consequences of the technologies that they've created. It's a little bit complicated to think that in that sort of way, especially since these companies have amassed such prestige in our culture. And also because we have become so dependent on them. But when something becomes so powerful, it's our obligation to apply some skepticism to it.
We're just about out of time. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I would feel remiss if I didn't get into this. And that's regarding your book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. You were formerly editor at a real paper and ink magazine called The New Republic. And while you were there, you got to witness firsthand the impact of Silicon Valley on traditional journalism when Chris Hughes, one of the founders of Facebook, took over ownership of the magazine. Can you tell us about that and why you reflected about your experience in your book? Was it cathartic?
So I'd worked at the New Republic for a really long time. It was my favorite magazine, a great place to work. I admittedly have a very romantic view of the magazine. But we'd had a really hard time navigating the future of media, much like many of our counterparts. But because we were so small and because in some ways we were so stodgy, it was maybe even harder for us than other people. And so Chris Hughes bought the magazine in 2012, and I was doing some writing at that time. And he asked me to come back and edit the magazine and work with him on reinventing The New Republic. And it was extremely exciting for me because Chris kind of came with this promise that we would find some sort of dignified way to create really serious, deep, nourishing media that would be able to thrive in the social media age. And it started out really wonderful. But then at a certain point, Chris decided that he was actually serious about turning a profit with the magazine and that he needed to turn things around. And so there was a lot of pressure on us to try to grow revenue. And the only way we could grow revenue was by growing web traffic. And the only way we could grow web traffic was by trying to master social media. And so Chris kind of knew the tricks to make that happen because of his involvement with Facebook and other startups. But for me, the real problem was just seeing what happens when you become so dependent on a platform and the ways in which the values of Facebook became the values of everybody else who depends on that platform, including us at the New Republic. And so we had to remake basically the subjects we covered them and the approach that we used to cover them in order to appease Facebook's algorithms and in order to achieve the sort of scale that people expect out of Facebook. And I found it a very corrupting experience where our seriousness was kind of sapped from us, and we made choices to produce things that were, in Chris's words, snackable content. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to producing nourishing things, we started to produce quizzes and lists, and we started to write about the same things that everybody else on Facebook was writing about. And this really got me thinking about the bigger picture, ultimately. After I got fired from the New Republic, because we had this ultimate bust-up over the future of the magazine, and I started to reflect back on what exactly had happened. And I could see a little bit more clearly the ways in which Facebook's power was diminishing something really valuable. And not just at the New Republic, but in the profession writ large.
So, but that's pretty standard with any media company these days. CNN and other major worldwide networks have to deal with a new reality of maximizing their output in order to fit in these little niches that you described.
Yeah, right. And so it's forcing us in all sorts of new directions. The first is that we all have access to data, and so we're trying to understand our audiences in order to give them what they want. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a pretty big reversal in the history of media, where media used to feel some sort of obligation to give readers what they deemed interesting and important, as opposed to giving them what they want. I'm presenting this in a little bit too black and white sort of way, but I think that the trajectory is clear enough. And it's also forced us into thinking on a much bigger scale, because once you're producing for a Facebook audience, you're looking to pick up readers all around the world. And even though Facebook is highly personalized, and even though it allows for the existence of niches, I think we all get sucked into trying to compete on Facebook's global scale rather than sticking to our niches. And then all of this ends up in a lot of formula, because the strong incentive is to produce things that work on Facebook. And the only things that we know that work on Facebook are the things that have worked before. And so you see in a lot of instances everybody gravitating to the same subject. You have organizations finding something that worked and just hammering it over and over and over again. And it adds up over time into something that's much more homogenized.
Franklin, I really appreciate you taking time to join us today to talk about things in the digital world and in the world of online media. It's really nice talking with you. Nice getting into it.
All right, I really appreciate the time.
And that's it for today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA. My guest for today's program has been Franklin Foer, author of a new book called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. It's been published by Penguin Press and is now available from your favorite bookseller. I'd also like to thank our broadcast technician, Justin Thwaites. This is Rick Pantaleo thanking you for listening today. And don't forget to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.